Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation into the subjects and topics that we really must know about. As you are all aware, this show is about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. If you are new to the show, please go over to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com. I have several free special reports there for you, and also my Facebook page, which is also What Women Must Know, has daily posts of more information and knowledge and articles, things that really will support you in getting empowered. That's kind of my message, getting empowered with truthful information. So, on that note, we're going to be talking about the topic today that I think is one of the most important topics that we need to understand and discuss at this present time. The focus of our conversation today is about vaccine myths and vaccine truths and getting the story straight. And my guest today is Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who will be helping us to understand and delve into the subject. But before we do that, I just want to say that this vaccination issue right now is just creating a maelstrom of activity, dissent, attacks on both sides. There's so much emotional energy going on around the subject. You know, this is a topic that is surrounded by many myths. We are very misinformed, and there is quite a bit of hysteria. There's actually a lot of hysteria when we have the discussion of vaccinations. And in fact, the state of hysteria and misinformation has taken us to the point where now there are many, many states who in their state legislature are requesting the mandating of vaccines without exemptions. So that means every child born will have to have a vaccine. No religious exemptions, no medical exemptions, nothing. You know, everyone must be vaccinated. And it goes even further than that. And I posted on my Facebook page the other day a review that asking for your comments about the government, the federal government's attempts to now mandate adult vaccinations. So we need to understand that we are all involved in this conversation, and we need to be informed, we need to be educated, and we need to be proactive if we do not want our health freedoms to be taken away and our personal freedoms that have been given to us by the Constitution. This is a really big subject, much bigger than I think most people realize, and we're going to be exploring it in as much depth as we can in the our show today. So first of all, let me introduce Dr. Andrew Wakefield to you. He is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School, part of the University of London, in 1981, one of the fourth generation of his family to have studied medicine at that teaching hospital. He pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He qualified as Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons in 1985, and in 1996 was awarded a Wellcome Trust Traveling Fellowship to study small intestinal transplantation in Toronto, Canada. He was made a Fellow of the Royal College of Pathologists in 2001. He has published over 140 original scientific articles, book chapters, and invited scientific commentaries. In the pursuit of possible links between childhood vaccines, intestinal inflammation, and neurological injury in children, Dr. Wakefield lost his job in the Department of Medicine at London's Royal Free Hospital. His country, his career, his fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists, and his medical license. Dr. Wakefield considers these losses a small price to pay for the privilege of working with affected families. In 2010, he helped to found Strategic Autism Initiative, a medical research charity dedicated to identifying the environmental causes for the current autism epidemic. He is co-founder of the Autism Media Channel, a TV and video production company that seeks to bring awareness and hope to those interested in childhood developmental disorders. And he's authored several books, the latest, which is Waging War on the Autistic Child. So it is such a great pleasure to have Dr. Andrew Wakefield with us today, discussing, exploring, and enlightening us on the subject of vaccination. So welcome, Dr. Wakefield.
Joe, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you are, for many of us, you're a hero, and for many of us, you are the incarnation of their worst nightmare. That's the medical profession's stance with the work you have done. And I'm sure you had no idea, when this all began in, 15 years ago, that this would be your destiny and that you would be traveling this very profound road in life that is having such an impact, but sacrificing much along the way.
Well, it's been 20 years. On May the 17th this year, it will be 20 years since I first received a call from a mother telling me the story of what happened to her child, very articulate mother, and clearly not anti-vaccine because she'd taken her child to be vaccinated on every occasion that was prescribed. And it's really been a fascinating journey, an exploration of how medicine should be conducted and, in fact, how in the real world various political and financial influences can corrupt the process of medical inquiry and lead to how you've so eloquently described this current nightmare of a situation where we are in a very, very emotive battle about personal rights, the rights of our children, who has control over our children's bodies and indeed for the future our own bodies, and what the special interests are that are driving this whole agenda.
Well, we have a lot to explore, and I thought we really need to start at the very beginning because, like so many of these issues, we get caught up in a very emotional response to this type of topic without real foundational knowledge. We don't really know what we're talking about. And I think we need to know what we're talking about when we have this conversation of vaccinations and are they good or bad and should we be mandated or shouldn't. Before we even get to that place, we need to understand what vaccinations are. And that's really where I want us to start today, with very fundamental questions like, what are vaccinations?
Right. Well, vaccinations are part of a public health policy to educate, or an attempt to educate, the infant's immune system by replacing natural infection with elements of the natural infection, or modified or attenuated, so-called attenuated or theoretically weakened versions of the original virus, such as measles, to produce an immunity which is effective, that protects people against the disease, and which is long-lasting, one shot or two shots for life. And this is the concept that we were originally sold on when we were told to take our children along for vaccination. And most importantly, that these interventions, which are given to healthy children across the board and are intended for ubiquitous use, are safe. Safety is absolutely the key. The problem is that even now we know so little about how these vaccines actually work alone, how they induce immunity, how they protect. And many of the things that we've been told along the way about one shot of measles vaccine for life will protect you, we realize that that is not the truth. Now it's two shots, now it's three shots. The fact is that the immunity induced by these vaccines is imperfect. It is not as good as the natural immunity induced by the infection itself. And the key question for me is not the need or the merits of protecting children against serious infectious disease using immunization, but how safe and effective are they? Principally, how safe? What safety studies have been done? how safe is it to give these vaccines individually? And now, clearly more importantly, how safe is it to give them in combination, many, many vaccines at the same time? Because there are 49 doses of 14 vaccines before 6 years of age now in the schedule. It's the most intense vaccine schedule in the world given in this country. And in production and in the process of licensing at the moment, there are over 200 new vaccines that the manufacturers hope they will get onto the infant and adult vaccination schedules. And you can see how hugely complex that's going to be.
I mean, that's a staggering number of vaccines. And to help people understand why there might be some concern, can you enlighten us as to what actually is in a vaccine?
Well, it varies according to from vaccine to vaccine. But for many, there are what is known to be in there. And then there are the unknowns. And I'll give you some examples of all of them. So historically, in vaccines like the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, in the hepatitis B vaccine, in the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, there was thimerosal. Thimerosal is a mercury-based preservative. It doesn't actually work very well as a preservative. It was never tested for safety. It was grandfathered in because it had been around for a long time. And there's no doubt that it is highly, highly toxic. Even in minuscule quantities, it is highly toxic. It should never have been in vaccines and most certainly should be removed from all vaccines now. Now, people will be told that mercury is out of vaccines, but it's not. It's in 80% of the flu vaccines that are required by healthcare workers offered to pregnant mothers and children over 6 months of age. Then there are substances called adjuvants, and adjuvants are substances which are there to enhance the immune response. So the bug itself, let's say diphtheria, is not capable of, the vaccine component is not capable of inducing a powerful enough immune response, so you put in an adjuvant, aluminum, with it to boost that immune response. Now, the problem is that aluminum itself is highly toxic to the developing nervous system and immune system. So it perverts the immune system in a way that the natural infection does not. So those are examples of what is known to be in there. There are also a whole lot of other things, elements of antifreeze, for example, and other preservatives and stabilizers. And then there are the things that we don't know about. And one example of this is the rotavirus vaccine. The GlaxoSmithKline rotavirus vaccine was found to have elements of a virus called porcine circovirus, a pig virus in it. And porcine circovirus, although not known to produce any disease in pigs, shouldn't be in this vaccine at all. And yet there it is, completely unknown, contaminant of a virus, a porcine circovirus. And so appropriately, the FDA removed that vaccine from the market pending further research. It then turned out that when they tested the Merck rotavirus vaccine, it had components of not just one porcine circovirus, but two. And the second one they found is known to be a pathogen, in other words, a disease-causing organism in young animals. Their decision at that stage was to put both vaccines back onto the market. An absolutely ludicrous decision, totally illogical. And they said the reason is that the benefits of this vaccine exceed the risks, but they didn't even know it was there, let alone not what the risks are. So there you have some examples of what is known to be in there, what is put in there by design, and then things which they didn't know that in there, that the health hazards are completely unquantifiable.
Do we know for sure that these vaccines actually are beneficial for the purposes to which they are prescribed?
Well, I think it's a very good question. It's part of the current debate. It's not where my attention has been. My attention has been much more on safety, but there is an overlap. And it's best to get a historical context on this. You know, measles was once described in the literature, the medical literature, as a mild disease of children, which rarely caused complications, produced lifelong immunity itself. And then by degrees, it became a killer disease. And if you read the recent reports on the outbreak in California, in Disneyland, then measles is the most terrible disease, I mean, ravaging people and causing. So the public relations message has altered this disease from being what it was historically, relatively benign, and becoming increasingly benign. This is the important thing. The mortality and morbidity from measles was declining dramatically before we introduced the vaccine. So if we'd not introduced the vaccine, what would have happened? Would that virus have become even more benign over time? Of course, we'll never know, because we introduced the vaccine, and everything that happened beyond that is put down to the benefits of the vaccine. We don't know. The truth is, we don't know.
So I want us to explore this whole issue with measles in a minute, but before I get there, I think it really needs to be emphasized that vaccinations start at day one of birth. Is that when they
are probably given?
So can you just briefly talk about a child's immune system? Does it exist when they're born? How, you know, what are we doing when we put vaccines with heavy metals, with viruses and other preservatives, chemicals, directly into the bloodstream of a newborn infant?
Right. When a child is born, it has two elements to its immune defenses. One is the ones acquired passively from the mother to protect it during the early months and years of life, and then its own developing, evolving immune system. And the passive immunity, let's talk about that to begin with. Mother gives antibodies, and she gives antibodies to various things to which she has been exposed. And let's take measles as an example again. Historically, mothers would give a good passive immunity to their infants, which would last for up to a year or more. And that would protect children from measles at a very vulnerable time. The problem with vaccination, an unintended consequence of vaccination, is that mothers who have been vaccinated as children do not confer good passive immunity on their children. So now the infant is susceptible under the age of one. They have become susceptible because their mothers were vaccinated. So that in itself is a, if you change the ecosystem, then you will pay a price. And the price in this case is that children under one are now much more susceptible to infection. And the other element to it is the developing infant's immune system. And this is a very interesting subject and is largely conditioned by the exposures that they receive early in life. So the gut bacteria that they acquire, very, very important in educating their immune system and their brains, interestingly, and determining their long-term risk of immune diseases, autoimmune diseases. So if you acquire your flora, your gut flora, your gut bacteria from your mother after vaginal delivery, then you will acquire her gut flora. If, however, you are born by cesarean section, then it's likely that you will acquire the first bugs you will encounter are those in the hospital, and they may not be as favorable. And we've looked at this in the context of inflammatory bowel disease, and it's very interesting that the risk of Crohn's disease is influenced by whether you are born by vaginal delivery or cesarean section. So a very interesting topic, but you have those two predominant elements of the immune system that influence protection in the infant.
You know, this is so profound, the consequences, as you were saying, the unintended consequences, because since mothers today have been vaccinated, which impairs their own natural immunity, they are compromised and not able to pass on the immunity that our ancestors had to protect us from a variety, just to create a strong immune system, really, which is what we're talking about here. So we've set up a pattern of this intervention that is compromising our immunity and making us more vulnerable to conditions, which then makes us vulnerable to the pharmaceutical industry approach of giving us more vaccinations, and so it goes on and on in ways that we just do not fully comprehend how they are impacting our health.
Yeah, and it's a very important issue you raise, and to continue to come back to answering your original question, if rather than giving natural exposure to infants, you are giving things like thimerosal in hepatitis B vaccine on the first day of life, which was the policy until recently, if you are giving aluminum, things which can profoundly influence the immune system in an adverse way, then you are setting that child up for, I believe, disaster. Because the effect of aluminum, the effect of thimerosal is to pervert the immune system, to divert it towards an excessive allergic immune response. And the problem with that is that if you upset the balance of the developing immune system, the child has a greater propensity to becoming allergic, in my opinion, to things they are subsequently exposed to, such as foodstuffs, new foodstuffs entering the gut. So I think that what we're doing is setting these children up for a disaster, particularly when they then subsequently encounter a live viral vaccine such as MMR. So there you've got three live viruses being delivered to the immune system of the infant in a way in which they have never been seen before in the history of evolution. Different strains, different doses, a different age of exposure, and three live viruses in combination. And that, in my opinion, is a big, big mistake.
And let's explore that, because this is where your story really aligns with this conversation today. I just want to ask you one question. What age is an infant given the MMR vaccine?
Now it's recommended at 12 months of age. Initially it was within the second year of life, 18 months, but it's been brought down. And in fact, I noticed after the outbreak in California, there were recommendations for it to be given in children under 1 year of age from 6 months onwards. And for reasons that we should certainly explore a bit later in this interview, I think that is a very, very dangerous precedent.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about where you have been a very very involved in this debate, in this discussion, and as you said, it started 20 years ago. As a academic looking at intestinal inflammation, as a gastroenterologist, what happened in your journey?
Right, a long story. I received that call from a mother on the 17th of May, 1995. And she told me a story which was to change my thinking about this completely. I had been involved extensively in researching Crohn's disease and possible viral causes of inflammatory bowel disease. And the mother called me and said, my child was perfectly fine until he encountered his MMR vaccine at around 15 months, and then he regressed rapidly into autism. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I know nothing about autism. It's so rare, we're not even taught about it at medical school. How can I help? And she said, my child has terrible gastrointestinal issues that his doctors put down to his autism. And he's got diarrhea 10, 12 times a day. Well, that didn't make any sense to me. He's failing to thrive. He's in pain. The mother would say, I know he's in pain because even though he's lost the ability to communicate, I'm his mother, I instinctively know he's suffering. And medicine is about listening to the patient, or in this instance, the patient's parents, in particular the mother, because mothers know their children like no one else, and certainly a whole lot better than pediatricians and public health doctors. So listen to the parent, and they will give you the clues. And so the other thing she said is there are many, many of these children around at the moment. And sure enough, we started receiving calls from parents with a very similar story. And so we set up a a program of clinical investigation with the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist, Professor John Walker-Smith, and we started to study these children, to investigate them clinically, and found that the parents were absolutely right. The children had an inflammatory bowel disease, not as severe as Crohn's disease, not as severe as ulcerative colitis, but nonetheless a distinct pattern of inflammation. So we treated that inflammation with the sort of medication that you would use in Crohn's and diets, exclusion diets of taking out wheat and dairy. And lo and behold, the children improved dramatically, not only from the intestinal perspective, they were out of pain, their diarrhea abated, but from the cognitive and behavioral perspective. And that was just more than a child being taken out of pain. They would start speaking again, using words that they hadn't used for many years. It was absolutely fascinating. That was the beginning of a very, very interesting journey. And no, from that point on, there was no turning back. Here, the medical profession had said one thing. The medical profession said, you're wrong. It's nothing to do with the vaccine. Your child has no gastrointestinal problem. It's simply that he's autistic. The medical profession was wrong. The parents were right. It's a very humbling lesson, but one that is crucial to doctors in training understanding right now at this very time. Now, if they were right about the bowel disease, were they right about the vaccine? And we had a professional and moral obligation to investigate that. We could not walk away from it. Unfortunately, many have walked away from it, knowing that it is very likely to be a real problem, but because they are frightened about their status or their job, their income, they have, I'm afraid, abandoned their patients in the process. However, of course, there is a price to pay for it, and the British government and the pharmaceutical industry were very keen to put an end to any vaccine safety research that might be done at the Royal Free. And I suppose the thing to do is fast forward 20 years, say, right, where are we now with this? Because parents must be saying to themselves, well, look, if there's nothing to this debate, why are we still talking about it? Why are we still having this discussion if this was all discredited all these years ago? And the reason is that it's real. The reason is that it's true. And now we've learned that in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, the Vaccine Court, then they've been awarding parents for neurological injury following immunization that leads to autism for over 30 years. And they have clearly acknowledged the autism vaccine link. And yet, if you listen to the experts, there is no link. I bet the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, which is fought. These cases are very, very contentious. They are fought on the science and the clinical presentation of the children, and they have come to the conclusion that the link is real. So that's number one. Number two, and even more importantly and very, very worryingly, we now have a senior scientist, Dr. William Thompson from the CDC, coming forward and saying that they have known for 13 years that the MMR vaccine autism link is real, that there is a causal association between MMR vaccine and autism, and they have concealed it. They have concealed it from everyone for 13 years, putting millions of children in harm's way, while physicians who investigate this have their careers trashed and are unable to continue their research, and much more importantly, children, an unknown number of children, are being damaged. So I'm afraid that's the situation we're in at the moment. And I think a lot of the recent brouhaha in the media has been an effort, an attempt to smokescreen the impending revelation of Dr. Thompson's expose on the vaccine fraud at the CDC.
We should say that he was one of the researchers, one of the scientists who developed the MMR or was investigating the MMR. Is that correct?
He didn't develop it. He was responsible in the National Immunization Program Safety Office for looking at safety, the post-licensing safety of the MMR vaccine. And what's interesting is that we put forward this hypothesis, which comes back to something you raised earlier about the developing immune system, that we put forward the idea back in 2000, I think, that the younger you are when you get the vaccine, the greater the risk. Why? Because of the evolution, the development of the immune system, it makes sense that the younger you are, the greater you are at risk of an adverse event. And we know this from measles. The younger you get measles, the greater the risk of an adverse outcome. And we told the CDC this at meetings in Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories and the Institute of Medicine back then, and that's what they went away and tested. They tested that hypothesis, and they found that it was true. And that's the secret that they covered up. And so you might argue that simply by increasing the age at which children are exposed, you might dramatically decrease the risk, and that is what has been found in reanalysis of their data. But they didn't do that. They didn't tell anyone. They decided that if there was any question mark over the safety of the MMR vaccine and thereby the vaccination program, that would be a disaster. Disaster at a public health level and a disaster for the credibility of the CDC members personally. I think that was, in truth, their overriding motive, and they covered it up as a consequence.
So they were taking care of their health rather than the public health, their financial health, their personal reputation health over the health of the public.
I can only believe that's the case, because if you were going to act in an altruistic way, if you were going to act professionally according to your job title, your job description, if you were truly concerned about safety in vaccines and the health of children, then you would have said, I'm very sorry, we've made a mistake. This either needs to be thoroughly investigated in a larger study, or we need to change policy now with an abundance of caution. Out of abundance of caution, even if this risk is not real, we must act to protect children. But they did not do that. They covered it up.
So just out of curiosity, there is a suit being filed against Merck based on this whistleblower information. Is that accurate?
No, that's in fact another issue, a separate case. We'll talk about that briefly. There is, on the first issue, William Thompson, what we have now are impending hearings of a government committee. There'll be a congressional committee convening on this, hearing Dr. Thompson's testimony and hopefully asking questions of his co-authors. And from that, we sincerely hope that there will be major changes in the governance of vaccine safety in this country. And I hope prosecution of those who are guilty. The other issue is equally interesting, and this is a whistleblower from the Merck Vaccine Lab, the Merck MMR Vaccine Lab. Merck were charged some years ago with proving that what they said on their product insert was correct, that their mumps vaccine produced 96% protection. And the reason that arose is that there were outbreaks of mumps around the world in highly vaccinated populations, colleges, schools, and other institutions. And these people had received two or three doses. So what was going on? Clearly, it was not working in the way that they were telling us it was working. Now, the problem for Merck, they could have resolved in one of two ways. They could have, broadly, they could have made a better vaccine in the interest of the public, or they could have altered the data in the laboratory about the effectiveness of the vaccine in the interests of Merck. And that is what they appear to have chosen to do. And in the end, the scientists in that lab were asked to commit fraud, to simply cross out the numbers they'd written down and replace them with new numbers that gave Merck the results they wanted. And they said, no, we're not doing that. And it's now in federal court under the Whistleblower Act. And I believe that Merck have been unable to deny the fraud because their own senior scientist in the lab who was responsible for it has, in deposition, admitted to that fraud. Now, the importance is this. Merck say this is not an issue of safety. Yes, it is. And it is because a mumps in children is trivial. That's it. It's trivial. Mumps, in boys in particular, after puberty, is not trivial, and it can cause testicular inflammation and sterility. So if you have a vaccine that does not work, and immunity wanes over time, then you are simply displacing the age of susceptibility upwards to a time when that disease is more severe. They anticipated that, and that's exactly what has happened. So a bad vaccine, a vaccine that does not work, is a dangerous vaccine for that reason.
Right. Absolutely. So there are two major events occurring that could profoundly challenge the CDC's ethics and also Merck's vaccines. There are the safety of their vaccines, which would challenge the whole policy that's going on of increasing mandatory vaccinations to the general population.
That's right, and you can see why it is totally inappropriate to increase the stringency of existing vaccine mandates, to take away philosophical and religious exemptions for those who have genuine concerns about the safety of these vaccines at a time when there is so much uncertainty, where you have admissions of pharmaceutical industry fraud and government fraud in the regulators. You cannot possibly pass new legislation in the face of that uncertainty until these issues are resolved. And indeed, you cannot pass that kind of legislation at all. You cannot say to someone, we will determine what invasive medical procedures you receive. You will do so according to government mandate. If you suffer an adverse reaction or your child suffers an adverse reaction, you have little or no recourse to any kind of legal action or compensation, certainly none against the vaccine manufacturers. There is no industry in this country other than vaccine manufacturers who are indemnified by the government against injury. So you as a parent are being told that you have your child vaccinated according to our rules or you are in violation of the law. But if your child is injured, you are left to pick up the consequences. That is absolutely unacceptable. And the Supreme Court in this country has said that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. It is known that they cause harm. Nearly $3 billion has been paid out to people who've been injured by vaccines through the compensation program. So it is unthinkable that you should remove people's rights to determine whether or not they're prepared to expose their children or themselves to that risk.
You know, Dr. Wakefield, I think people who are listening to this conversation, maybe never really delved into it before, find this so incomprehensible. There is so much evidence proving that vaccines are questionable, evidence that there has been fraud, that there are these dangerous ingredients in them, that there has been up to $3 billion paid out for vaccine injuries. The pharmaceutical companies have immunity to any prosecution. They're protected from any of the dangers that could occur from the result of getting vaccinations. And yet, vaccines are perceived as the best thing for our health. And it's just incomprehensible for me to imagine that we can really buy this story. But I guess that's the point. We have been given a story. There is a lot of propaganda out there that has played on our emotions, played on just misinformation, lies that have stirred up all of this fear in people that make them want to support mandated vaccinations and having their newborns vaccinated and the whole, you know, flu vaccines for the elderly who have immune compromised health, which could be further compromising their immunity. I mean, it's just so bizarre that we have gotten to this place with, you know, a seemingly intelligent population.
Yes, I think what we're experiencing now is a propaganda war. It's not about the science at all. You hear that the vaccine safety science is in, that there is absolutely no link, that millions of children have been studied. And yet, the last five papers that have been published on Thimerosal using the vaccine safety data link, those are studies using the CDC's own database that they set up for monitoring vaccine safety. The last five studies have shown clear evidence that thimerosal is linked to neurodevelopmental disorders. So people are either not reading the science or they are lying to the public. And this is a matter of fact. It's a matter of public record. This is something that can easily be checked. But you hear time and time again this same mantra being put forward to the public. And it really is extremely sad. Just as an example of this, historically, the mumps vaccine, again, let's just talk about that. When they decided to bring in a mumps vaccine, it was against the background of the CDC saying there is no need for this vaccine. The public health in England said exactly the same thing. This is a trivial disease in children. It was introduced for it as a commercial imperative to make money for the pharmaceutical industry. And once it was on the schedule, the CDC decided that they had to turn mumps from a benign disease in childhood into a much more severe disease. So the caption was, more serious than you think. In other words, the whole language of describing mumps had changed. In an interview between Patrick Tierney, who's a New York Times best-selling author, and Donald Henderson of the CDC, who was the head of the World Smallpox Elimination Program at the World Health Organization, he said that the Merck data on mumps were a pure air creation. His own words, a pure air creation. And that is what is delivered to the public. So this is the CDC admitting themselves from a very senior level that the data were a pure air creation. And the public need to know that.
Okay. I want to go back to your work as a gastroenterologist and this connection with the MMR vaccines, gastrointestinal issues, and autism. What goes on when you get that vaccine that is so damaging to the gastrointestinal tract? What? Why? And what's that link to autism?
Well, you know, that's a very, very good question. And most of what we know is, or most of what we think we know, is actually hypothesis or theory. There are certain things that are clear, and that is, these come from clinical observation, and that's the starting point, is that the children, in many cases, have an inflammatory bowel disease. That when you treat that disease, there is an amelioration of the behavioral symptoms. You never get rid of autism per se, but you can make a child's life a lot better. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that there is a reversible element to this disease. It's not fixed. It's not hardwired completely. There is a reversible element to it. Now, that's against the historical backdrop of being told by the autism experts, the psychiatrists, that it was hardwired, it was fixed, the damage was done, put your child in a home, get over it, they're never going to speak, they're never going to... That is not the case. And that gives great heart to people that we can explore that reversible element and even enhance that recovery process. So that's number one. So there you have a myth demolished that this is a hardwired, fixed disease. It's not. How is the gut injured by MMR, for example, or thimerosal? We know that measles as an infection can cause inflammation of the intestine. And one of the common causes of death and morbidity in African children is diarrheal disease following measles. So is it possible that you are causing inflammation, that then the child becomes exposed to foodstuffs to which they were not previously allergic, but then become allergic, they become sensitized? And so this is how the gluten and casein issues play in the foodstuffs that we eat, having an influence on our behavior. Gut bacteria having an influence on our behavior. Some fascinating studies done now, and it's important to point out to your listeners that one of the most consistent findings in children with autism is that they have altered gut bacteria compared with developmentally normal children. Very, very interesting. And other papers have shown that gut bacteria not only influence our behavior, but the development of our brains in the first place. So fascinating. We are, no man is an island. We are, in the words of one researcher I listened to the other day, we're 9/10 bacteria, 1 part human. So we need to look after the bugs in our gut very, very carefully. And they're essential to our good health. So there seems to be some interaction between the immune system in the bowel, the food we eat, the bacteria in our bowel, and knock-on effects in the brain. And that's not to say that there isn't some underlying neurological injury, but that injury may make us more susceptible to these changes in the gut. Now, that all sounds terribly circuitous and complex, because it is. We don't know. There's so much more that can be done. I suppose the sadness for me is that if the science had been allowed to take its natural course all those years ago, we would be so much further ahead in our understanding of this issue. And of course, children would, I believe, have benefited enormously. But because the bowel disease was synonymous in the minds of many with vaccine injury, then that had to be crushed as well.
I would surmise, I mean, it's just my conjecture, that maybe things like thimerosal, which act as an antibiotic, go in and destroy the gut flora, which can contribute to compromised gut health. I don't
know. Yes, it is. No, thimerosal itself has been shown to produce a colitis, mercury, mercuric, and inorganic mercury, been shown to produce a colitis. So there are a whole host of mechanisms by which these substances might potentiate the adverse effects one of another.
You know, you were saying that right now there are up to 49 different vaccines that have been listed for children. It just boggles my mind. There cannot be 49 life-threatening illnesses that a young child is exposed to that requires that many vaccinations in a lifetime even. I just cannot fathom the rationale other than the financial benefit for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, I should be clear. It's 49 doses of 14 vaccines.
Okay.
But with the intention of introducing up to 200 more vaccines into the schedule. So here's the sort of rationale, and this is, again, people need to know this. Why would you give hepatitis B vaccine on day one of life for a disease which is sexually transmitted or through the use of intravenous drug abuse? Why would you do that? And Neil Halsey, who was one of the architects of vaccine policy from Johns Hopkins, was asked it at a public meeting in Louisiana. Why would you give my child this vaccine in the first 24 hours of life? And he said, because we can. That was the reason, because we can. What exquisite arrogance. What does that mean? Is that the scientific basis, because we can? It's unbelievable, because children are not even exposed to the risk factors for this disease, except in the rare instances of transmission from the mother, until they are at least teenagers. And the reason is now, the rationale is that once you get a child into the program, the vaccine program, they become more compliant with the rest of the program. So if you start them on day one of life, irrespective of protection against disease, irrespective of safety, then you've got them for life. That's the thinking of the CDC. And that is a disgrace.
You know, this is so unbelievable. It's like we're living a bad movie. You know, we're caught in a horror movie. You know, and this is why this type of conversation is so profound. We have to lift the veil. We have to get out of the matrix and really understand what is going on, because the information we're given and the huge amount of pressure put on parents and the condemnation of parents that even question vaccinations, and now this attempt to mandate, to convince state legislatures that this is a good idea, is a really terrifying development as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, I just want to say we had a conversation about 2 years ago, Dr. Wakefield, we were talking about my concern about the use of Gardasil, this quote-unquote, you know, cervical cancer vaccine, a human papillomavirus vaccine, and so we're giving this vaccine to our vulnerable 11, 12 year olds. We're giving all these infants vaccines. We're giving our seniors the flu. We're giving pregnant women flu vaccine that have shown to increase the incidence of fetal deaths. I mean, it's across the board where we are given these vaccines without real validity of their safety, of their efficacy. That's why it's a huge story. And that's why I want to make sure we have some time in this conversation to do two things. I would like your advice how to build our own natural immunity so we are able to be strong. We don't require vaccinations, whether they even do the job is debatable, but at least we need to understand to put our focus on building a strong immunity. And also, what are some places of action we can go to register our complaints, our concerns, to be part of a movement that is really demanding change and protection for the public?
Right, it's a very good question. The answer to the first question is clearly wide-ranging. It starts with the mother ensuring that she is healthy, well-nourished, that she avoids toxins, that she, and indeed her husband, because this is a generational effect, and people need to make sure that preconception they are in the best of health. And I'm not the best person to answer this, but I am aware that there is a great deal of interest in this subject at the moment, how to get yourself in the best possible physical condition for pregnancy and how to optimize your child's health in terms of nutrition and immune system development. And there are some very good doctors who've written widely on this. I think Andrew Usman from Chicago is one of those. But I would recommend that people search on that and on the internet, look up doctors like Andrew Usman and get the expert guide to how to get yourself in the best possible health and preserve that health for the benefit of your as yet to be conceived, let alone unborn child. So that's one thing. The second is what can we do? The first thing we have to do is to stop the madness of these mandates at the moment. And I'm delighted to say that first of all, this is in your hands. It's in the hands of your listeners. It's in the hands of the individual to exert their democratic rights to make sure that this does not happen. And it works. Believe me, it works. It has now worked in five states where they've tried to push mandates: in Oregon, in Washington State, in Maryland, in New Mexico, and one other I heard of last night. I don't remember which. But this is so important. You have to get in touch with your representative, your congressman. He is obliged to meet with you, and you must tell him of your concerns. And what I strongly recommend you do, there are some very, very good sites, including Autism Action Network, and go to autismmediachannel.com, and there you will find two downloadable PDFs. And those downloadable PDFs are the official complaint about the whistleblower from the CDC, Dr. William Thompson. You don't have to know those in great detail, but do read them out about your own interest, but make sure they are in the hands of your congressman and say to him you cannot possibly support legislation to increase the stringency of mandates in the face of the admission of fraud by the CDC. Here is the information. And also go to the National Vaccine Information Center.org, NVIC.org, for some excellent information on what is happening in your state and how to take action to prevent it. So it can be done, and this has been proven now repeatedly in different states. But you can bet that the pharmaceutical industry are lobbying. These are their bills. This is what they want to happen. They want cradle-to-grave vaccination. They want to own your body, and that's where their profits will come from. And you've got to intercede and remind your representative that he represents you and not the pharmaceutical industry. And I think we're getting growing support. It does work. Please do it. It's your responsibility. You do not sit back and let someone else do it because you're too busy or can't be bothered. You've got to do it, because if you lose this liberty, then you have lost it for a very long time. And when those other 200 vaccines come in, it will be you who is forced to get them.
You know, what happens if you refuse those vaccines, Dr. Wakefield?
Well, the plan at the moment is that it becomes a matter of law that you get vaccinated, unless you can show a cast iron medical exemption, which is going to be very, very narrow. Then what will happen is they will deem you an unfit parent, and they will take your child away. They will make them a ward of court, and they will give them all of the vaccines that they have not had to bring them up to date, and they will do it all at one time. And that is going to produce catastrophe. You will be potentially imprisoned during this period, and you are then put on a register of being an at-risk parent, and there will be constant vigilance by the state of you and your children. And I was telling a story the other day when we met of a mother in California whose child was administered 8 vaccines on the same day at 5.5 months of age. His behavior changed immediately, and 48 hours later he died. They were told this was nothing to do with the vaccines, although clearly, explicitly, it was caused by the vaccines. And now that mother is pregnant again. And if these laws pass and she declines immunization of her new baby, he will be taken away and vaccinated again. And can you imagine what the consequence of that is going to be? So this is the real world. This is what is actually happening, what is intended. And people say, oh, I don't believe this is going to happen. Imprisonment, surely not. Well, in Pakistan, over 500 parents were just arrested and imprisoned for not giving their child the polio vaccine. Can't happen here? Yes, it can.
Well,
it will happen because the pharmaceutical industry will do everything in their power to make it happen.
So what are those websites again? Can you repeat them, please?
Yes, certainly. Autism Action Network.
Okay, autismactionnetwork.com.
.com. And try.org. I'm not sure. It may be .org, I think.
Okay.
And NVIC, National Vaccine Information Center.org, NVIC.org. And the other one is the autismmediachannel.com.
And I just want to add one more thing. People need to go. I posted on my Facebook page about mandated vaccines. The federal government is now planning to have forced vaccines on adults, and you need to go to the federalregister.gov and lodge your comments about it. They're asking for comments, and I think we should all go there. You can just go to my Facebook page and look up that posting about mandated vaccinations. So this is something we actually have to get involved in. Dr. Wakefield, it's been such an honor and a pleasure to have you with us today. I want to thank you for being such a hero to all of us and helping to spread the truth. Take care. God bless.
You're very kind. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And to all of you listening, well, I hope you will take action. Please do. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You've been listening to my conversation with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And until next time, remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Thanks for now.